Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who do you trust? Has your faith in the stability and good intentions of the agencies and organizations you interact with changed over the last very rocky couple of years? If your trust has declined, you are hardly alone. An annual global survey put together by public relations giant Edelman finds 77% of well-informed Americans trust corporations less this year than last, leaving us with lower trust in business today than even the months following Enron and the dot-com bust. That lack of trust has many people changing the way they do business and openly questioning whether more government regulation might prevent future economic freefalls. So how are businesses and lawmakers reacting? My guests today are here to offer their expert perspective. Matt Harrington is U.S. CEO for Edelman, whose 2009 Trust Barometer is available free online at edelman.com. Former U.S. Congressman Michael Oxley today serves as vice chairman of NASDAQ. Matt, Mike, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris.
What does it mean, Matt, to trust a company?
Well, there are a number of factors. Trust in leadership, trust in the products and services that you're getting, and trust in the promise of the relationship that you're having with the company.
Is that trust directly related most of the time to how well individuals are doing? Is it hard to sort of separate those two things?
No, I think it's an instance of the consumer or stakeholders in relationship with the company. And what we saw in the last trust barometer that we fielded in November was the really precipitous decline in trust in all institutions. So we look at government, business, media, and NGOs or non-governmental organizations. And individuals, those we surveyed, actually felt less trust in all of those institutions across the board. The greatest loss of trust, though, was in the business community. Perhaps not surprisingly, but the size of that drop, as you pointed out in your introduction, was far greater than what we experienced back with Enron and the dot-com bust in the early part of the decade.
And globally, you found that 62% of people had a lowered trust in corporations over the past year. What are people telling you they worry about?
Well, they're worried about a lot of things, obviously, in this environment. But I think they're worried most about how is business going to recover from these times and the intersection with business and government and whether they, in fact, can partner in a civil fashion, if you will, to actually address some of the major problems that we're facing. So there's great concern over whether business and government together can address energy issues, affordable health care, or the economic crisis and do that in a way that actually does provide leadership.
Mike, one of the solutions that many people think of at this point is greater regulation. Is there any doubt in your mind that this crisis will increase the level of government intervention in U.S. business?
Well, it's already happened, of course, Chris, with government intervention. Who would have thought that the taxpayers would be the majority shareholder in Citigroup or basically own AIG? But it's happened. Frankly, it happened under a conservative administration. So the world has really, truly changed, and I think we're going to see more of that. We're hopeful that instead of more regulation, we'll have smarter regulation, emphasis more on transparency in the markets, market-based solutions to the problem. The Congress has already started hearings and looking at different ways to address that. After all, we've got a early 20th century model for our regulatory structure in the 21st century when a lot is going on. There are a lot new, more products out there. The whole concept of an investor nation has changed dramatically. We used to be a nation of savers. Now we're a nation of investors. And that has changed the whole process in which how we look at these kind of things. And this is going to play out over the next several months will be critically important because whatever structure the Congress agrees on will be around for 75 or 80 years as the current regime is. And obviously those decisions will last a long time. We really have to make sure we get it right.
Do you think it will be around for 75 or 80 years? Do you think perhaps we waited too long before and then, of course, we deregulated a lot of things? Should we start looking at these changes that we make as things that are sort of less permanent and more a response to exactly what's going on now and then revisit them in a decade or so?
Yeah, but it doesn't happen that way. It happens because you have a crisis or you have something extraordinary happened. Enron and WorldCom brought about Sarbanes-Oxley. We could have sat around and tried to pass a bill like Sarbanes-Oxley in a vacuum, and it would have never happened. The votes wouldn't have been there. That's just not how the process works. What happens is a crisis demands action by the political leadership, or as Rahm Emanuel, the new chief of staff for the White House and a former colleague of mine, says a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And what he meant by that was that it gives the political process an opportunity to step in and take a good look at what went wrong and what holes were in our regulatory structure and try to change them for the better.
So let's talk about this idea of an investor nation. Is there any reason to have more faith, and at this point it seems no one has any faith in anything, but more faith in institutional investors than in the average person sort of making decisions about their kid's college fund or their retirement?
Well, I think that we actually are moving a little bit away from being as focused a shareholder society and more of a stakeholder society, and that that investors, individual investors, are probably going to have a more engaged relationship with the companies in which they are investing than they might have in the past. They may have been more trusting, if you will, of the mutual fund positions that they took or what they felt they'd, you know, the bets they'd placed in their 401k. And that trust is now completely eroded with the opening to anybody who's got the stomach to open that envelope. It's really pretty tough medicine to take. And I think that people now will look at companies in a more holistic fashion, not just the performance on and sort of Wall Street, but how are they engaging in civil society? How are their products representative of what an individual and an investor wants to associate themselves with? So I do think that consumers are going to probably come out of this period looking for more responsibility on the part of companies and not sort of living in the report card solely through share price.
Well, for a long time, we were really getting sort of mixed messages. We were told, on the one hand, know what you're investing in and pay attention. But on the other hand, people were saying over and over, if you go into a fund of some kind, you almost don't have to worry your pretty little head because someone who has the time to look at all these things can pay attention to individual companies. I mean, what's realistic in terms of asking people to pay attention to their investments when they have full-time jobs doing other things? How much can they pay attention?
Well, very little, I think, and that's why you have investment advisors. That's why you have mutual funds that are, for example, the most exciting thing to come along in like 401ks is this lifetime where you start saving for your future in 401k, and early on you're heavy into equities, and then as you get older, it automatically readjusts your portfolio into safer products like bonds, for example. And
so you're talking about, excuse me for a second, when you have a target year for retirement, your target year is 2010 or 2020.
Yeah, so if you're in your 20s and 30s, you can take more risk because you've got that long-term. And obviously, over the years, equities have produced the best returns on investment in a long period of time. And then as you get older, it becomes a safer investment. That is a fairly new concept that I think will stand everybody in good stead. But for old folks like me, it's a whole different deal, and I think we've learned from some of that. And you know, over 95 million Americans own mutual funds. We've become a nation of investors. 54% of American households own stock, and they have embraced the whole concept of investing. Now, this has been a huge body blow to that belief, and as Matt indicated, and to try to restore that trust after it was banged up pretty good after Enron and WorldCom, where we lost $8 trillion in market cap, that was restored, but it took a while. And this is going to take even longer, it seems to me. I don't think anybody has all the answers right now.
Did we make a mistake in assuming that after Enron, everything was over, that was the big learning experience and that we were sort of done after we fixed the problems there?
Well, again, I think we have a different problem. That's the thing. Yeah. I think we went a long way in solving the problem of accounting fraud and making it more transparent and accountable and the like. And there's far less likelihood you're going to have another Enron or WorldCom, where you had illegal behavior, fraud, with that particular company. Now, this situation, as I said earlier today, was, in my estimation, caused by a lot of leverage, and then a lot of bad decisions made by smart people based on really bad information or no information at all. And there were a lot of smart people that thought that because of the products that were developed and insurance against risk, that they had essentially eliminated risk. Well, that, of course, brings about over-the-top greedy behavior that led us to where we are today. I think a different situation than we saw back in 2001, 2002 with Enron and WorldCom and all those companies.
Since we're talking about trust and transparency, Matt, do you think that in focusing on the accounting problems and scandals that we diverted attention from some other things that otherwise might have caught our notice earlier?
Well, you could make that argument when you look at the whistleblowers who are trying to get the attention of the SEC on Madoff, and now it appears on Alan Stanford as well, that for some reason, if there was the presumption that we'd fix the accounting oversights, that nobody needed to be listening to other sort of wolves in the wilderness calling out. But I think that it is, as Mike says, an instance where there were just too many sort of wild bets being made on instruments and even on lending credit that was well in excess of what was necessary or appropriate given the where reality was.
And really based, I think, Chris, on the underlying assumption that housing values would continue to increase. There was this almost messianic feeling, not just in Wall Street, not just with Fannie and Freddie, but all over the country, that this was a God-given right, that the house that I buy is not just a place to live and raise a family, but it's an investment, and that I can use it in some ways as a piggy bank and take some money out to fix it up or to put my kid through college or whatever. And it changed the whole concept, and the whole country in many ways bought into that. And so when that started to go south, it brought down, as I think CNBC did this program called House of Cards. And truly, I think that's a good phrase to describe it.
One of the groups that took a huge hit this year, and it seems to happen all the time, was media. People don't trust the sources of information that they've been getting. So what's your sense right now for who they are trusting?
Well, I mean, media has been one of the least trusted industries, media companies, now over the last several years of our barometer. And it's interesting in as much as, by the same token, one of the most trusted vehicles is business magazines among those we surveyed, which tend to be opinion elites. So they are giving credit and trusting experts, business magazines, where there's maybe more detail or delving into subject matter than in mainstream media. But I think where people do trust right now is when they factor and aggregate all voices. So they're listening to multiple channels and bringing their skepticism and or their credibility orientation towards, you know, CEO, but CEO coupled with other voices, with employees, with the neighbors and, you know, sort of people like myself. And they filter all of that information and are trusting. One of the interesting things of the study is that the younger group that we surveyed, 25 to 35-year-olds, stood in contrast to the older cohort, 35 to 65, in that the younger group were more trusting of media than the elder group. And I think they were looking at media very broadly. So they're thinking of Wikipedia and they're thinking of, you know, social networks, but they're bringing sort of their own ears and eyes, if you will, and opinions to how they aggregate and discern all that information. So it's multiple channels. It's not just a single source.
My guests today are Matthew Harrington, who is U.S. CEO of Edelman, which has just released its 2009 Edelman Trust Barometer. You can find that online at edelman.com. Also, former Congressman Michael Oxley is here. He is currently serving as vice chairman of NASDAQ. You're welcome to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests today are Michael Oxley, former U.S. Congressman, currently Vice Chairman of NASDAQ, and Matthew Harrington, who is U.S. CEO of Edelman, which has just published the 2009 Edelman Trust Barometer. You can look at it yourself online for free at edelman.com. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to go back for just a minute, Matt, to something that you said before the break, which was that younger people tended to trust media sources as they define them more than older people. Do you think that's a factor of their relatively greater engagement with even contributing content to those sources of information?
Yeah, it's a great point, Chris. I think it is absolutely that the engagement with media, particularly online, is much more dynamic. So they're actually having a conversation with the reporter who's written the story, that's prompted an idea, and they've been able to provide feedback. So the ongoing chat, the ability to blog with Floyd Norris at the New York Times creates a different sense of relationship than I think traditionally people have had with media, where it's been very one way. And this sense of two-way dialogue, I think, enables the younger cohort to maybe feel better and more trusting about the kind of relationship they're establishing.
On the other hand, trust seems to be at an all-time low for people like corporate spokespeople when they're getting out there. That's got to put a company like Edelman in a tough spot.
Well, and or opportunity. So, I'll look at it from that standpoint. But you're right. We have to work with our clients to help them understand this new dynamic and the fact that they can't have a control and command attitude or approach to the marketplace and anticipate that they can introduce or manage a message into the marketplace. So CEOs and or their spokespeople, they absolutely have a role to play, but they need to understand that people are putting a filter through what's being heard. So they need an echo chamber, if you will, of third parties and or employees who can reinforce the message and be credible about that. And I think that one of the things you're seeing these days is that CEOs who actually will speak both to their employees and outside external audiences who do it with candor and sort of consistency in terms of acknowledging what maybe's gone wrong, what steps are being put in place to change and or manage the current situation, are having a lot more success. I think you look at Warren Buffett's letter from Saturday. You know, he's right out there front saying, worst year of our performance at Berkshire Hathaway. These are where we stumbled. But this is sort of now how I envision it. We'll be able to walk sort of out of the woods. And that's the sort of consistent candor that we've gotten from him, and others are beginning to behave and model accordingly.
As you sit, Mike, currently overseeing NASDAQ, how serious do you think the problem is of people making sort of panicky decisions right now?
Quite a bit. I think that as much as the people hear the admonition not to try to time the market, if you will, you reach a certain – I think they reach a certain point where they just give up. You know, they're so upset, so frustrated that they do that, and no amount of – cajoling or arguing will change that. I mean, it clearly is part of the market psychology. It's the same way on the way up in the opposite direction, where you want to get in because everybody else is getting in and you don't want to be left behind. Same kind of thing happens on the downside. Before I joined the NASDAQ, when I was still in the Congress, we had the dot-com bubble burst. And if you remember...
I remember it well.
Right. I mean, some of these dot-com companies had a higher market cap than like General Electric. They were advertising on the Super Bowl, paying millions of dollars. They never really made anything. They never even made any money, but they became a kind of a pet investment vehicle for all these folks. So, and of course, as a result, when the bubble burst, NASDAQ lost like 15% of the companies that were listed because of that. So. It's a very frustrating kind of thing to get people to understand. And, of course, again, a lot of people are relatively new to the markets. As I say, that tradition changed over the last 25 years from a nation of savers to a nation of investors. People would put money in their passbook savings account. They'd get a relatively small percentage, but they felt better. They were at least ahead of inflation. They were risk averse. And then when these vehicles came out, like 401ks and IRAs, they became enamored with the returns that some of these investments were getting, and they lost sight, I think, of the fact that there was risk involved. Unlike their old passbook savings account, were incredibly safe, and you had FDIC insurance and the like. And so that has changed as well. And even with FDIC insurance, I mean, we had 100,000 coverage for years. And when I was chairman of the Financial Services Committee, I introduced a bill to increase it to 130,000 and then to index it for inflation. Because we looked at the numbers, and 100,000 had been on the books for 20-some years. And because of inflation and so forth, 100,000 wasn't the kind of protection that you would get today. And I introduced that bill, and we were attacked from Chairman Greenspan, from the White House, that, oh, this is inviting moral hazard, that people will take chances. And so when we get this problem with the banks, guess what? In 48 hours, the Congress administration raised it to $250,000 and then made it permanent. It was, first of all, it was temporary, and then they made it permanent. So we went from 100,000 to 250,000 in almost literally overnight, when in fact we were getting slapped down for trying to go to 130,000. It gives you an idea about how the world has changed, and it's never going to be the same again.
So you talk about us having been historically risk-averse as a country. I'm wondering whether you think everyone's going to come back into the market when things start to turn up again, or are there people who have been so badly burned that they're going to, you know, stick with Treasury bills and very, very safe investments?
That's a great question. If you look back on what happened after Enron and WorldCom, we lost $8 trillion in market cap. I mean, a lot of people forget that. We lost a lot of market cap. A lot of people got out of the market. Not just people that had Enron or WorldCom, but frankly, what happened was Enron was the seventh largest company in the country. They were being reviewed as the best company to work for, the company of the 21st century, the most ethical company, all of this stuff. And frankly, if you were a financial advisor, you were probably advising your clients to own some Enron stock as well as WorldCom. You could have probably been guilty of malpractice had you not done so. So a lot of people were into that market. And all of a sudden, these people who were first relatively new into the market and felt pretty good about the returns, Enron was getting 20% of returns a year, and people feeling pretty good about it. All of a sudden, this is a cold shower for them. You know, they're taking risk, and they see that risk. That had a huge impact on investors, and that's why we ended up passing the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and we saw that confidence come back slowly, but it came back. People made the calculation that there were a few bad apples out there that took advantage of the system. We cleaned it up. Some people went to jail. They paid fines, and the structure was better. The regulatory structure was better. Companies were more transparent. They were going to more accountable as a result of the act. And people, I think, felt more comfortable getting back into the market. And then we get this blow, which is just another one. And so you question about how many times. Winston Churchill once said that when you tell a child not to touch a hot stove, he's probably not – if he touches that stove, he's probably not going to touch a cold stove either. And that's the issue you've got with the investors. You know, they've touched that hot stove. And if that stove is the market and equities, even though that stove may be cold, they don't want to take any chances. And I think it's a real concern. It really is.
Well, not just to add to Mike's point, we do a correlation between the S&P performance and trust in business. And there's a very tight correlation in performance. And we saw the trust in business increase after Enron, rebuild over time, and the performance of S&P accordingly rebuild, and the decline commensurate in the last year. And I think that crisis of confidence in investing is something that needs to, you know, we need to know when we've hit bottom. Nobody seems to know when that is. And once we've hit bottom, I think it'll be a low, slow crawl out of the basement, if you will. But it's possible based on what we've seen previously.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guests this hour are former Congressman, now Vice Chairman of NASDAQ, Michael Oxley, and the U.S. CEO of Edelman, Matthew Harrington. Our email address is think@kera.org. Joe asks, considering how much the public has been harmed by major banking and Wall Street corporations, why should we trust them?
Well, I think that you have to believe in the resiliency and the ability to change in our country. One of the strengths of our system has been this ability to own up to our problems, recognize them, and fix them, you know, and move on. And we have a history of doing that, and we're we have a very solid reputation, I think, of doing that. It is based on trust, but it's also based on the fact that you have human failures, you have these trust issues. I mean, I was just making a list of some of these entities over the last few years that have had real trust problems. The Catholic Church, obviously business, politicians and government in general, the media, we talked about that. It seems like it's always somebody's turning the barrel around here, and that's not all bad because it forces us to face these issues and problems and then come up with solutions. And in every case, we've done that. And in every case, we've come out stronger and better for it. And you have to recognize that you're dealing with human beings, you're dealing with all of these vagaries of the human nature, and this stuff happens. It's like the bumper sticker, you know? And so you got to deal with this, and ultimately, I think, long-term, we're all better for it. I would think we would be in a serious problem long-term in terms of raising capital, creating jobs and the like under our system if people stayed away and put their money under a pillow, which is the attitude that a lot of people have right now. And I just think we really have to think long and hard at how do we get that public trust back in a broader sense to be able to take risk. Not just crazy, over-the-top risk, but risk that can be quantified. And as a result, that's how we're going to grow. And I'm confident, at least, that that's going to happen. Warren Buffett, in his letter that Matt mentioned, is right at the end of the letter, said he's very bullish on the long-term prospects of this country. But at the same time, as I said this morning, this is the first time we've had a global recession. This is the first time that we've really had a global recession where everybody is struggling. So you don't have one or two countries that can be the engine of growth and pull us out. Everybody is out there with a tin cup, and that's a very frustrating situation.
So let's talk about reality for a minute. You've both mentioned the importance of transparency for individual companies and organizations. Let's assume for the sake of argument, Matt, that we have a company with impeccable intentions that really wants to do the right thing before there is regulation requiring everyone to be as transparent as that company chooses to be. If it goes out and reveals some things that may not look good in the interest of transparency, is it taking sort of a personal individual risk that makes it appear to every other company watching this as a case study that it's not worth it?
I think the not worth it is a function of over what period of time. Mm-hmm. So it may be that in the immediate 24-hour news cycle, there's a fair bit of ugliness and, you know, people piling onto the car accident. The larger question is, how is the company continuing to engage and communicate? So are they identifying and having healthy conversation with people who actually have issues with what they're talking about and with those who give them credit for taking the right action? Are they getting those voices out in the mix as well? So I think that there is an ability for companies, and you see companies doing this right now where they're getting ahead of the curve in their own industry. And while they may be the short-term decision is to reduce headcount and resulting in layoffs, but they're ultimately interested in the protection of the business for the long term, they are taking those short-term hits for a long-term gain. And if they're doing it from a communications perspective correctly, they're being transparent about that, and they say what they're going to do, they go out and do it, and then they prove that they're making progress against that. So it's the continuous conversation that I think is incredibly important.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a bit mystified. This whole situation is very surreal because I hear these two gentlemen speaking about, a better corporate message to bring back confidence in investors. And I hear them talking about, restoring confidence. But how does that correlate with the amount of debt that is there? I mean, systematic drawdown of oversight and regulation has led to leverages that are insane in governments, in corporations, and with the consumers. Now, I mean, assuming that we have a clawback of even 10 or 15% in consumer spending, you correlate that to GDP, and we're looking at a pretty nasty scenario.
Well, Scott, well, before we get an answer for you, I want to ask you very briefly, what would allow you to feel confident about putting your money back in the markets or about spending money?
Massive amounts of prosecution and bankruptcies of entities that need to fail. You were talking about the opaqueness of these companies, and they're opaque because if you go and look at their books, they're insolvent, and the government is propping them up. Why would you invest in a situation you have literally no confidence in? I mean, these many, many companies, and in fact countries, are bankrupt, and we'll be dealing with the ramifications for years. I mean, I would love to think like Warren Buffett does that, you know, we're going to be out of this thing at the end of the year, but I see a depression. Call me crazy.
Thanks very much.
And it's going to be many years.
Thanks very much for your call, Scott. Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think he hits a very critical part of this, and I think that there is a lot of that sentiment out there. There was a lot of that sentiment, frankly, after Enron and WorldCom and the like, because people said, you know, who can we trust and where do you put our investments and our money? And so I have a great deal of empathy for him. One of the things that hopefully we learn from the Japanese decade, the lost decade, was that Japan allowed these banks that were really insolvent to kind of just hang around. They called them zombie banks. They really didn't do anything except hide the fact that they were in a deep, bitter hole. And I think most of our government leaders and regulators understand that we can't make the same mistake that Japan made. Japan virtually did not grow for 10 years. And we are the largest economy in the world. And if we went 10 years without growth, it would be catastrophic. So I think we're on that and dealing with that and trying to buck up balance sheets and to eliminate some of these companies that or these banks that can't exist. But it's a tough slog, and I think the gentleman that called has a very valid point.
Michael Oxley is with us. He's a former congressman and vice chairman of NASDAQ today. Matthew Harrington is here as well. He is U.S. CEO of Edelman. They have just put out the 2009 Edelman Trust Barometer. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Matthew Harrington, U.S. CEO of Edelman, which has just published its 2009 Trust Barometer, and former Congressman Michael Oxley. He was a sponsor of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and currently he works as vice chairman of NASDAQ. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Brett in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great, good show. I just had a quick comment, and that was I haven't necessarily lost faith in the companies, but I've actually lost faith in the ability of our government to oversee it and regulate it. Our own president, the other president, was saying that, you know, everything was just fine, and then it just a tornado took the whole economy down, and that's my comment.
Thanks very much. And that brings me to an interesting element of the study, Matt, which was that just because people trust corporations less doesn't automatically mean that they trust government more.
Right. So the good news for business is they're trusted more than government. But the flip side of that means that they...
Even now.
Yes, even now. 38% trust business and 30% trust government. Government of our four institutional buckets has actually been among the less trusted over the last several years. This year, I think what the studies calls out, though, is an expectation that government's going to provide solutions and that they need to do that in partnership with business and with NGOs. So there's no single author of solutions. but that government needs to be very much at the sort of helm. And I think you see that right now with Barack Obama in terms of his calling to arms sort of everyone to be party to the solution, and that business, in fact, has a table, a place at the table on some of these policy issues, at least offering a point of view.
Can you talk for a minute, Mike, about having served in the House and I'm sure being well aware of the public's, you know, waxing and waning sort of trust in government officials? Does that cause people who are actively serving to sort of discount the need for trust, to assume that no matter what you're doing one way or another, that, that people aren't going to recognize that, that you're trying to do this in good faith when, in fact, that's happening?
I think there's a little bit of that, but I'm reasonably encouraged by my colleagues and in the House. I think a lot of people forget that, and we talked about it, you talked about it earlier, about a lot of members now use ways to kind of bypass the mainstream media to get to their constituents, to debate issues with their constituents. Twitter and all of the new devices that are out there, some of my colleagues are doing that. They encourage emails and that. So the bond between the constituent and the congressman probably has never been better and more open, which allows for some really good debate to take place. It also allows the members to really feel the pulse of the public even better than just a few years ago when we dealt with the Enron WorldCom situation.
So it's less filtered now.
It's much less filtered, and I think that's a positive development. Getting to what the gentleman commented on, the biggest issue right now in terms of regulatory structure is we don't have an entity to deal with what we call systemic risk. That is, if a small bank in my hometown fails, it fails, but it doesn't. It's not a systemic kind of thing. But if you get a Citigroup or an AIG, that's a systemic risk problem. That affects all of us, and not just in the country, but all over the world. And so one of the focuses is going to be how do we regulate, not necessarily regulate, but how do we identify systemic risk, potential systemic risk out there, and then how do we deal with it? We need a center fielder, if you will, to take a look at the whole system from 30,000 feet, because you've got the SEC in their little box. You've got the banking regulators in their little box. You've got the states who regulate insurance in their little box. But nobody's really looking at this whole thing and how it works. And so now you think, geez, AIG was an insurance company. Many of their entities was regulated at the state level. You've got the SEC issues, but they missed Bernie Madoff. You need somebody, and that's going to be a big debate in the Congress, and whether it's going to be the Fed, whether it's going to be a new creation, that's going to be, I think, the $64,000 question, how you deal with that long term. And again, we're relying right now on an early 20th century model for regulation that clearly is antiquated and doesn't work.
If we are going to effectively mitigate systemic risk, does that also mean realistically that we put a governor on the amount of profits that certain industries can make?
No, I don't think so. I think what you do is you for example, the SEC made a terrible mistake in 2004 where they raised the amount of leverage that the investment banks could take to 30 to 1, 40 to 1, in some cases 100 to 1. And the banks went in and asked the SEC for that leverage so that they could actually participate more in the mortgage-backed securities market. Well, that was a recipe for disaster. And so those kind of things, it seems to me, need to be better understood and limit the amount of leverage. So had the banks been able to have to stay under their old limits of leverage, which were about 10 and maybe 15 to 1, the damage would have been far less. But, of course, that didn't happen. So you need a whole the role of the credit rating agencies, both in the Enron case and then currently. You know, how can you understand that a credit rating agency is rating some of this stuff AAA? And, of course, that's the coin of the realm for particularly foreign investors. They see AAA rating from Standard & Poor's. Boy, they buy it up. Well, they didn't know what they were buying. They were buying a lot of toxic assets in that package of mortgages. And here it's AAA. They figured, okay, good enough. So you really have to take apart this whole process and think it through and really renew and remake the regulatory structure. because we can't rely on a 1934-1933 vision of regulation because, like it or not, we're in a whole new world here.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Janet in Dallas. Hey, Janet.
Hi. I've been listening to many, many conversations such as this and been trying to learn from them, but there's one point that I think has always been overlooked when talking about individual investors, and in particular people who have 401ks or, say, 403bs. And I don't know when this started, but at some point companies did away with pensions so that employees were basically, that was their choice, was to invest in a 401k or 403b. And generally they were encouraged because I know one place I worked had 4% matching, another place had 6% matching. But my problem is finance and investing is not my area of expertise, and I think that's true of many people. And so we were kind of all stuck in this boat, and now we have no pension, and of course our money in our 401ks or whatever we have is tanked. And I just think that point has kind of been overlooked.
Yes, what do we say to folks like Janet who feel like there's not a fully safe option for retirement?
Well, it is true that the old traditional defined benefit plans have disappeared. That was part of, I think, if you look at the auto industry, for example, part of the problem the auto industry got itself in was these commitments long term to these defined benefit plans that they're finding it very difficult now to finance. And so I think the idea of involving the individual and allowing the individual to make these choices was a good one. The lady is accurate in that a lot of people don't have that sophistication. One of the changes that have been recently enacted is to have what they call a lifetime investment strategy, where it automatically changes your investment portfolio as you age, so that you can take more risk in the early years. You know, if you're in your 20s or 30s, people in their 20s and 30s look back on this and say, well, we took a hit, but now we're 50s and 60s, and the market has come back, and you know we have a good safe investment. And I think it's too bad we didn't start that earlier to take care of people my age, but that's the way it is. But I think that change is a dramatically positive aspect to it. The other question is, where would you – in the absence of a defined benefit plan, which I think it's really a dinosaur now, and they're going to disappear if they haven't already, what's the alternative? You can't put your money under a mattress. You can't – if you put it in a passbook account, it doesn't really keep up with inflation. So there are only certain ways that you can invest. And then lastly, I'll say we tried and we finally got a bill passed in the Congress to allow for the company to provide investment advisors to their employees. It was fought tooth and nail by the unions, believe it or not, for years, which made no sense to me at all to allow these employees to meet with these folks and give them good, solid advice. That's what they need. And these people aren't dumb. They just need some information so they can make the decision by themselves. And I think that's also been a major change, a positive change.
I want to go back for a minute, Matt, and talk about the survey, this barometer, because you talked about you've selected informed publics, which is educated people who keep up with the news. What do we know about the correlation between informed publics and sort of everyone else who may not be as well educated or may not keep up? Do those people tend to sort of look to these other individuals as opinion leaders? And does their approach to thinking about these things track with that?
This year, it appears to track very closely. Nielsen did a study in October of consumers, not just as it relates to what they generally track, which is media absorption or consumption, but they did some testing of how consumers were feeling in general about the economy, financial institutions, et cetera. The numbers bear very close correlation to our trust barometer of opinion elites. Previously, you know, we've looked at opinion elites a bit as the early adopters of trust in institutions, and that they – one of the, you know, who do people trust? They trust experts and analysts and people like themselves. So when you look at that troika, the sort of average man on the street, if you will, is looking to that sort of, you know, mother-in-law research married with expert opinion. And so that's why we focused in on maybe the opinion elites being sort of the early wave of shifts in sentiment. This past several months, there's, you know, the news has been so uniformly poor and consistently carried abroad in you know, media and in what people are opening up in their envelopes, that everyone's sort of in the same psychic space.
A year from now, if we have been listening carefully to analysts and things are still dismal, are they sort of on the precipice of falling off on that trust barometer as well?
Well, I'd like to think in a year we'd return and be able to talk about a modest recovery.
I think that would be delightful.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I'll make a date for it, yes.
And I think to one of your caller's earlier points, Warren Buffett actually did not call out a significant change at the end of this calendar year in terms of performance. He expects it's going to be pretty heavy weather going forward for some bit of time. And I think that may be one of the few things people can agree on. But I think that we should see optimally, you know, hopefully we've hit bottom, some incremental progress, and that the opinion elites recognize that. It isn't just about good messages. It's got to be about performance. I mean, equally important is performance. And we need to see some quarter-on-quarter incremental improvement based on some of the actions that companies have been taking to demonstrate that, you know, we can address this crisis in confidence.
Will there be a sense of upward mobility and motion without major additional government regulation at this point?
Yes. I mean, I'm confident of that. I think the markets can rebound, and I see that.
We keep saying we've hit bottom.
Well, you know, who knows? But I think it really it's the inevitable American spirit that you always have innovation. One of the things that separates us from many other countries is the incredible innovation that we have, the ability to take risk, having risk, fairly high risk tolerance to produce the kind of things that we've been able to produce. After all, we have more patents from the United States than in the whole world combined, and it's been that way for a long, long time. We don't want to see that change. We don't want to see the oppression of over-regulation squash that ability to take risk. And the average investor needs to understand his tolerance for risk a little better as well. And frankly, we all, as Americans, have learned a valuable lesson here, it seems to me, a very painful lesson. And one of them is, you know, you don't go out at $40,000 a year and buy a $1 million house and expect that the value of the house is going to keep up to the point where you that just doesn't work. And so we've learned the hard way, and maybe that abject lesson that we have will lead us to better things in the future. I happen to think we are. With the resiliency, Chairman Greenspan used to testify for our committee twice a year, and it would always, his theme was always this incredible resiliency the American system has, our economic system, our political system, just the common sense of the American people ultimately prevails. And we're getting a lot of good music. That's a good optimistic thing to end on, yes.
The former Congressman Michael Oxley today serves as Vice Chairman of NASDAQ. Matthew Harrington is U.S. CEO for the public relations firm Edelman. You can find the Trust Barometer report at edelman.com. Guys, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.